the business principles that are used in commercial businesses don't always transpose perfectly into the caring context. But again, the other common thread is you must look after your team, because you need to have a good, strong team, because otherwise, as one single individual, you cannot achieve the goals that you set out to achieve.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. This is Ben Morton, and welcome to episode 45 of the podcast. In this episode, we are talking about having difficult conversations and really looking after our teams with Leslie Young, who is the CEO of Epilepsy Scotland, a role she's been in since 2009. Her interest in improving the lives of those who live with epilepsy is born out of a professional and personal experience. As a qualified nurse and midwife, she has seen the impact of this long-term condition, and as a mother, she has experienced the real impact that epilepsy has on the individual, the family, and the community they live in. Leslie is a long-standing member of the Institute of Directors, the Criminal Justice Disability Advisory Group, the Police Scotland Independent Ethics Advisory Group, and a panel member in the Social Entitlement Chamber of the Judiciary. In this episode, we speak about the challenges and opportunities associated with leading in the charitable or third sector, along with creating an organisational culture that enables people to quickly and successfully adapt to change. In addition, we dive deep into Leslie's thoughts and approach to having difficult conversations and really looking after the people that we have the privilege and responsibility to lead. So, without any further delay, let's dive right in, and I hope you enjoy my incredible conversation with Leslie Young. Leslie, a very warm welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us today. And before we get stuck into the questions, can I just ask, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Ben. And I'm delighted to be able to speak with you this morning.
Well, we'll say this at the end, but I really appreciate your time. And I'm sure there's going to be lots of fascinating stuff for people to hear and learn from. Leslie, would you mind telling us what your current role is? And a little bit of the career journey that got you where you are, please.
Sure. At present, I am the Chief Executive at Epilepsy Scotland. Epilepsy Scotland is the national organisation, very obviously, representing people living in the country who have epilepsy. As for the journey, Ben, it's been an interesting one. I started my working life as a general nurse and sister in a gynecology ward way back in the 1970s. I also did my midwifery. So my knowledge of epilepsy, to be fair, was pretty limited. And I really had no intention of specializing in anything other than gynecology. That was my passion. Anyway, you know, life doesn't always go as planned. And what really introduced me to epilepsy and the organization was my daughter, who at the age of 10 months old, became quite unwell, and eventually, after a long, long time, was diagnosed with a fairly rare syndrome called PCDH19, which comprises epilepsy, autism, and learning disability. And as a result of that, obviously my interest in all three elements, but particularly epilepsy at that time, because it was having a significant impact on all our lives, brought me in touch with Epilepsy Scotland. And my career here started as a sessional trainer. So essentially, I went round Scotland and sometimes ventured into England to share the information, the knowledge, and the way of looking after people who had difficult to manage seizure activity. And then I was asked if I would become the interim training manager, because the young woman filling that role at the time had to be off long term. Then my predecessor, the chief executive at that time, decided that she would move to pastures new. And for my sins, I was successful in applying for the role, and I have been here in this role since 2009.
Wow. Leslie, I didn't realize from our previous conversations that your career had started in nursing and midwifery. And when I heard you say that, it occurred to me straight away to ask, how or in what way do you think that has shaped your leadership style? And I guess this is a slightly leading question. I'd be accused of leading the jury if I was in court. But for me personally, and listeners will have heard me share this before, I have a really strong belief that the job of a leader is to deliver the results that we're accountable for, and to look after the people that we've got the privilege and responsibility to lead. So I just wonder kind of how working in that caring profession where it's very much about being of service to others, kind of has that shaped your own leadership style, would you say?
I think there's a number of things that have shaped the style that I work with now, if I'm truthful. I think if you set out at the beginning in a caring profession, that element of your natural personality is always there. So that always comes to the fore. And you are quite right, of course, you're not just caring for, at that time, your patients, but the people that you work with, your team, and you have to look after them as well, because if they're not doing well, either physically or emotionally, they can't look after others who need them even more. So yes, I would agree with that. What I would add, however, is that between my nursing career and coming to Epilepsy Scotland, I did also have some privately owned businesses, one which offered occupational health consultancy, and the other was a home care provider. But all the way through, you can see that there's one common thread, and that's caring of some description. But it's the context. So you have the context of the National Health Service. I worked in private healthcare and then provided care through business. And so you learn that the business principles and the management styles that are used in commercial businesses don't always transpose perfectly into the caring context. And so you look at how you can apply them, where you can apply them. But again, the other common thread is you must look after your team, whichever sector you work in, because you really need to have a good, healthy in every way, strong team, because otherwise, as one single individual, you cannot achieve the goals that you set out to achieve.
You spoke then about some of the leadership management principles that don't necessarily apply or translate directly into some more of the sort of caring type professions and industries. Are there any particular ones that stand out for you, or kind of any particular obvious ones?
There's a couple. When you're managing human beings and their welfare, they could have exactly the same diagnosis and have, let's say, the same operation on the same day, but they will recover differently. If you have two people who have been diagnosed with the same kind of epilepsy and their seizures manifest themselves in the same way, they will respond to and their management will be slightly different, because no two of us are exactly the same. So if you apply a business principle that this is the process that from start to finish that gets you your end product, you can't apply that to anything that a human being is involved in, because the end product, it will be quite different. The journey to get to the end product will be quite different, because you cannot always anticipate how a human being is going to respond to that. So when you're dealing with individuals like that, the business principles can go askew. So if I give you an example of service users who pay for some services, and it doesn't have to be Epilepsy Scotland, but in the third sector, and they fall behind in their payments for whatever reason, would you apply the same restrictions to that person that you would to a paying customer where they haven't paid for a box of paper or a box of pencils? So what we did here is we would allow three gentle reminders to go to that individual or the person paying on their behalf before we started to look at how we would have to deal with that in a more business-like fashion, for want of a better expression. So the application is there, but it's a bit more flexible because there can be many reasons for that delay in payment.
Well, that's really interesting, and I've never even stopped to consider that. And as you was talking, I think what was resonating in my head, and I think I heard you say, was very much sort of some of the metrics that we use, some of the forecasting, maybe sort of capacity planning, will be much, much more nuanced, and we need to kind of not look at the numbers so literally, right, when we're working in sort of your sector.
Yes, yes. And I think this is often, there can be a lot of debate around this, because my view is that Epilepsy Scotland is a not-for-profit organisation, very obviously, but we do want to make a surplus, and we want to make that surplus because we need to be viable, but equally we want to be able to research into how we can enhance the existing services or introduce new services. So we do look at that from a very business-like perspective. And I would equate us to an SME, and where it is at all possible, apply the principles that anybody would use when leading an SME to the charity. But I can't apply them right across the board for reasons that I've described. And that's when we look at, well, do we want to charge for something? Do we want to monetize a service? So the example I would use to illustrate this is one of our income generating streams is to give epilepsy training to a whole variety of people and different agencies. However, and obviously that's paid for. However, when a family approaches us, who either has a son or a daughter or a spouse or whatever the family member who has been diagnosed, and they need to have that training, we would not charge that individual because it's our view that they have enough to contend with. The new diagnosis of epilepsy and the way it impacts the individual's life, but also the ripple effect of that impact on their immediate family, their extended family, the community, the school, the work, etc. They have enough now on their plate. So we would look to give that training free of charge. So it may be that there's another difference from a purely corporate approach.
That's a fantastic lead-in, Leslie, to another question that I wanted to ask you. So I think kind of everybody probably knows that funding is a ongoing challenge for all charities, regardless of sort of which particular charity it is. And in the CEO publication article that I read about you, which is how we connected, I saw in there that you'd shared how you'd had to make, I think it was a particularly difficult decision about making a complete line of the business, the charity, redundant. I just wonder, how do you personally go about making those tough, challenging decisions where there isn't necessarily a right or wrong, black or white answer? And when you do them, how do you sort of have the confidence in the decision, or how do you have the courage of your conviction?
So it's not a decision that I make on my own. That's the first thing to say. As you might expect, in this particular instance, the numbers did speak for themselves. And it was becoming increasingly obvious that if this line of business were to continue, there would be an increasing deficit, and one that would probably not be recoverable from. And so I gathered all my evidence, and I take that to my board of trustees. And so I'm very fortunate to have a very involved and a very dynamic and supportive board of trustees who look after the governance, but also they're the strategic overseers, if you like, of the organization. And it's my job to put the operational side into gear to meet those strategic aims. So I take that suggestion with the evidence to them, and essentially then it becomes a collective decision, and it is then a process that is followed so that we are fair and consistent to all, and we would look to seek guidance from employment law experts. We have HR experts on our board of trustees, and we would follow that process. We are a small organization, Ben. Before that decision was made and came to being completed, we were about 64 people strong. At present, we're about 24. And so we do know everybody pretty well. And of course, it is by and large me who sits across the table with another to talk about potential redundancy, etc. So you develop everybody who is in a leadership role, if they haven't already done so, will at some stage develop a coping mechanism, a mantle, a cloak of some description that they may in their minds put on. Because what you want to do is always remember you're sitting across from another person, a person that you know how they work, but you have a job to do, and you have to do that to the best of your ability. You have to be fair, you have to be open, you have to be consistent, but you also have to survive at the other end. So that's where all your coping mechanisms come in. And you also need to be able to decompress. And again, I would turn to the chair of the board for that, or a mentor, or someone similar. Is it easy? Never easy. I would say that if it becomes easy, then it's time for you to look for something else to be doing. And do you ever question things? I think it would be wrong of anybody to do something without questioning it. And then you just do it to the best of your ability. So that one was particularly difficult, because not only were you dealing with colleagues, but you were also dealing with people who were using the services and their families. So that probably, if I'm truthful, was the most difficult to be carried out in my whole working career.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, Leslie, perhaps it's a result of the times that we find ourselves in, but I'm finding myself being asked a lot at the moment by senior leaders for tips, advice, support with having challenging, difficult conversations. And I think I've started to arrive at the realization, certainly reflecting on me personally, my ability to have those conversations. Like, I don't think necessarily that difficult conversations sort of get any easier, or we learn any particular tools or techniques to enable us to have them. I just think it's a sign that perhaps those leaders that appear to be good at them just get more comfortable with the discomfort of doing them, if that makes sense. Not that the conversation gets any easier, or we don't kind of think about them and we don't find them difficult ourselves, but we just become comfortable with that level of discomfort, and we understand the kind of the conversations that have to be had. Kind of, would you agree, or do you have different thoughts around that?
From my own experience, what I think is the answer to this is that one learns to listen more. And that difficult conversations are often easier if one develops the skill of truly listening to the other person and asking questions, asking how they would deal with the particular issue to hand, and taking time to respond to what they have said. I think the level of discomfort, as you describe, probably sits easier as you are longer in your career, but it never disappears totally. But I would suggest that probably the greatest skill to make it easier is to actively listen to the other person. Because I think you said right at the very beginning, if not in one of our previous conversations, nobody really sets out to make the wrong decision or a bad decision or to make a really significant mistake that has a negative impact on individuals or a company or a charity. So let's look behind that and find a reasonable starting point. There are, of course, times when you really just have to steel yourself. You have to accept that this particular conversation is going to be particularly difficult, and that often emotions run high and are raw, and people are going to get angry and upset, and you have to be able to cope with that. And again, to go back to something else you said, I would suggest that my many years of working in the NHS and, you know, in hospitals prepared me well for this, because you as a senior nurse were often, if not the person who was sharing unwanted news, but you were beside somebody who was sharing that unwanted news. So you would learn from them as well.
I'd imagine as well, in your first career as a medical professional, you were either taught or very quickly learned on the job to actively listen, right? In terms of listening for symptoms, signs, reading body language, as well as kind of what's said. And that's a skill that not that many of us are particularly kind of taught in life, are we? How to really listen. And I think so often it's the case that when we're in conversation, particularly maybe if it's a difficult conversation or about kind of bad news that we have to share, we're not really listening to what the person is saying. Often we're listening for a pause even, so we can jump in and say what we think, and we don't truly understand the other person's perspective or view or emotions, right?
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, you can work with an individual or a group of individuals for a long, long time and think you know them, but you don't really, because many of us leave our own feelings, our own experiences from home and don't bring them to work. And others are less skilled at hiding difficulties, etc. So it is only when there is a time for an uncomfortable conversation. Now, that uncomfortable conversation could be actually saying something like, I've noticed that you've not been your usual bubbly self. Is there anything that we can do at work to help that? It's not always in the context of potential redundancy or disciplinary or disciplining, even. It's just finding out why that person is not the way they were a week ago, 10 days ago or something, and is there something we could be doing to help them get back to the way they were?
Yeah, like I really believe in that, and I have this strong belief that so many things that end up being a significant sort of performance management process at work, where we're sort of following the latter ends of some of the formal HR processes, it's so often something that started out very, very small that has just snowballed and grown, that actually through knowing our people better, through stopping in, checking in with them, listening to what's going on in their world, could have been prevented earlier on and saved everybody a lot of stress, heartache, and poor performance in the business, right? Just if we pause to connect and see the human beings in front of us.
Well, do you know, I think it's all about communication. And we here, some might argue we possibly do too much. But if you look at the turnover of staff in the organization, we have people who have been here for 19 years, 15 years. We don't really have a high turnover. And of course, I would say this, wouldn't I? I would suggest it's because we do look after our team well. So we have 4 weekly monthly support and supervisions with everybody. We have a monthly chatter with the whole organization. Every single one of the senior managers operates an open door system, even though we're doing that virtually at the moment. And we have, for those on our frontline services who are dealing with very difficult calls on our helpline, and we have a check-in service, that type of service offering. We have non-managerial support. We very proactively use occupational health. Over the period of lockdown, I chose to phone every employee, every one of my colleagues, every week, just to see how they were doing. And we sent them handwritten notes to make sure that everybody, including those who were on furlough, understood they were still part of a team. They were a valued member of that team. And so we didn't really have any problems. And then preparing to come back, sent out it was a fairly standard template questionnaire thing to ask about preparing for coming back to what's now called the hybrid model. You have to keep up with these names. Yeah. I'm sure there's somebody gets paid a lot of money to come up with these different names. Anyway, from the hybrid model. And did they have any difficulty in thinking about it, anxieties, etc.? And a couple were identified, and we dealt with those proactively. And so it's all about communication and making sure that your colleagues, your team members, all know that you think they are valuable, what they give to the organization is valuable, and they can't be thought to just be disposable, really, because nobody really should ever think that way.
I love what you said. Well, I loved all of what you said. It's so, so valuable, especially right now. But I just think you just can't underestimate the power of a handwritten note, right? Like, it's we receive few of them these days, but they are so powerful. Whenever I mention it, invariably someone will say to me, "Oh yeah, I've still got one that my boss of 8-10 years ago wrote to me. I still keep it. It kind of still makes me feel good or smile." Right? It's so powerful getting a handwritten note from the boss or a colleague.
Yep. I couldn't agree more, because somebody has taken the time to commit their thoughts and their feelings to paper, and it's just completely different to the blunt instrument of an email or a text or whatever. And if ever I was on Desert Island Discs and they asked me what I wanted to take, it would be a writing set.
and a packet of thank you notes.
Yes.
Leslie, let me change tack slightly. You are the creator, founder, not sure what the right term is there, of hashtag SWOT. Can you tell us what that is and why you created it, please?
Yes, if you knew me better, Ben, you would understand that something will trigger a thought, and I mull that over for quite some time because it's made an impression on me. And SWOT really was the result of me being very fortunate, really, to meet 3 very strong women in a very short period of time. Now, these 3 women were of very different generations, very different backgrounds, and were performing in very different roles at the time. And the last one in particular really hit home. And I came away from that meeting thinking, my goodness, that's a strong woman. And then, of course, my usual thought processes kicked in. And I then began to think there has to be lots of strong women out there. And hence hashtag SWOT. And really what I wanted to do was share the experience, not the journey, but the experience of these strong women, whatever their background, whatever their age, and whatever it was they were doing now, where they had to really dig deep into their pockets of strength, if you like, their reserves of strength, whether that was physical strength, emotional, intellectual, a combination of all, what brought about that actual need, how they dealt with it, and what they learned from it. So set up, essentially, it's a luncheon when we were able to do that. And we would have one speaker who would come for about 20 minutes, share their story with questions, etc., all done under Chatham House rule. And the other thing that I thought was important for everyone who was interested was that we should look to inspire the next generation of strong women. And so at virtually every lunch, whether it is actually face-to-face or virtual, which we have been doing, we like to invite one or possibly two young women who are either still at school or just starting in their career to the lunch, so that they meet a network of people they wouldn't have the opportunity to meet until much later on, or at all, and just learn from them and be able to share some of the experiences that they've had. So I actually have a lunch at the end of this month. We're having a live stream from South Africa.
Wow.
A very dynamic woman over there who has set up some schooling, etc., for rural areas of the community. And we have invited two young women who I sit on the judging panel of the Crown Office public speaking competition. And this year it was won by two young girls who gave a phenomenal presentation. So they're going to come to the lunch and they're going to give that same presentation to us and join us for lunch. And hopefully that will start something rolling for their career planning and development. And what else does it get them? Well, at one of the lunches, our Cabinet Secretary for Health at the time, Jean Freeman, was at the lunch. Two other girls gave a presentation which was taken to the First Minister. And so that conversation started to happen with them, because it's all about, their presentation was all about equality and diversity. So it's just that sharing of not the journey, but the experience and the need for strength, because we've been talking a lot about strength in difficult conversations, etc., and sharing that with younger women so that they're a little bit more prepared than they might be had they not attended the lunch.
It sounds incredible, Leslie. Where can people find out more if they want to, or maybe even get involved?
Well, they just need to go on to the Epilepsy Scotland website, and it's very clearly highlighted there. And the contact would be my senior manager, Gemma Fleet, who is the coordinator for me. So just on the Epilepsy Scotland website.
We'll be sure to put the link in the show notes for everybody listening.
Great.
Leslie, I want to be conscious of time. So final question, I think. I'm intrigued to hear your answer because we started talking about it before we hit record. What would be the one book that you'd recommend that's really had the most impact upon you?
I'm a voracious reader, and so I could give you a long list, but the one that I think has seen me through the pandemic is The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse by Charlie Mackesy. It is very much a book for this time. It can be read in not many minutes, half an hour max, I would suggest, and I can tell you very truthfully that every night I either read the whole book or a section of it, because there's bits in it that relate to things that have happened in the day. And it's just a great read, a very deep book, just absolutely right for the time. And I would recommend it to everybody.
I'm a big believer that when the same thing keeps cropping up over and over again, then it's time to act on it. So I'm going to go and buy that book today, because I believe it was Sasha North Bond from Octopus Energy also mentioned it. So yeah, so that's going on my reading list straight away. Leslie, thank you so much for your time today. It's always a sign of a great conversation when I've only gotten through about half of the planned questions, which is absolutely the case today. Just, I absolutely loved our conversation around sort of difficult, challenging conversations, really looking after your team, and also kind of hearing about all the work you're doing with SWOT. So thank you so much for your time. I know that everybody listening is going to take huge value from this episode. So thank you very much.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much for inviting me.
I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks, but most importantly, I really hope that you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. If you did get value from this episode, then please do rate, review, and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again in the next one very soon, and lead on.